Hi everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Breakfast Conversations with your host Jacob. Oh, hang on, no, not that Jacob. I'm the other Jacob. I'm the Cornish Jacob. I'm actually kind of taking the lead this week. The tables have been turned. In fact, the breakfast tables have been turned, you could say, and it's now actually dinner time. I guess it's breakfast time somewhere. And my guest today is the other Jacob, the actual Jacob who made this podcast that I've just jumped on and apparently am now running. Hi, Jacob. How are you?
Fine. It's weird to be on the other side and suddenly being asked for getting interviewed, but looking very much forward to it.
I feel like I should ask you, Jacob, what's your breakfast at the moment? What are you having at the moment for breakfast?
Yeah, right now I'm getting a very, very strong coffee. It is late in the evening, but I have had a really, really busy week the last week and have had different kind of events and board meetings every evening. So besides all the work, I haven't been really at home for the last 6 or 7 evenings. And for the last 2 days, I were at a event for board members at public schools in Denmark. They have always a board where parents also are involved. And then I'm on one of those boards. And there was this national meeting for board members today and yesterday. So I'm just coming back from that and have been involved in school politics here in Denmark the last 24 hours.
Wow, that sounds like a very busy week you've had.
Yeah, so I can imagine strong coffee.
Yeah, I imagine there's been perhaps a lot of interesting conversations happening during those meetings.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's really interesting to see what people are thinking about, in which direction the public schools should go in here in Denmark, especially when the parents are involved, to hear how they are thinking about the children's future and what kind of schools would expect from schools today. So
I think it's great to get those different stakeholders involved, especially the parents, because they have such a close relationship with that school.
Yeah, and I think it's
always important, isn't it? Yeah.
And I find it quite interesting here in Denmark that we have this mix that it's public schools and of course the politicians that are making the legislation, but still that every school has a board where the leadership of the school are involved, but also the parents have actually most of the seats in those boards. But also a couple of seats for the students, and we have also the possibility to have one member on the board that is coming from a company or NGO, local community member on the board. So I think that is quite interesting to have this local democracy on the schools that have something to say about the direction of the school. But not
Absolutely,
always
yeah.
as ambitious as I would like it, but I think the construction of the local democracy idea is really good.
But to be there and add your input into that as well must be quite a hugely valuable thing. And I can imagine you leave quite a lot of interesting conversations there to move things forward into the future of education.
Sometimes I struggle a bit because I'm not that patient always. I really would like to have more future-focused conversations than we have, and not only about lunch boxes and so on.
All the interesting stuff, lunch boxes and, yep. So I wanted to have a little chat with you this morning, this evening, whenever we're pretending this is happening, because you actually hosted a really interesting Twitter conversation during the week just gone. I don't know how you found time to fit that in with everything else. But you had a really interesting conversation with educators all around the world about what the future of education will look like. And I just wanted to kind of chat to you a little bit and find out how that came about and your experience with that chat, really.
Yeah, I think I have followed the Twitter chat for a couple of years now and really found it interesting also just to get this feeling of community once a week and participating in the chat as something really valuable. And suddenly, when they asked for new hosts and so on, I thought, oh, that could be interesting.
Yeah.
But I must also admit, it's really, really busy that 1 hour as a host, all the notifications coming in, all the. I think there were so many, many great ADEs joining us at the last Twitter chat.
It was a really busy chat. There were loads of people there, and new faces and old faces, a really nice mixture of people.
Yeah, and normally I find it interesting to see all the conversations, and I know that I only see a few of them, but actually being a host and wanting to give people a good experience, replying to their questions and liking and so on, it's... it felt like I have run 10K afterwards, just sitting
there. So from a practical sense, were you doing it on an iPad or a MacBook? Or what device were you using? Or do you have multiple devices all lined up like in a film?
Yeah, actually it was both the MacBook, where I had used TweetDeck.
Oh yeah.
And I had scheduled all the questions before.
That's good.
So that they were going out automatically, so that I could concentrate on commenting and reading people's replies and so on. So that was on the MacBook, and because I have a little bit of dyslexia, I find it much easier to actually use speech to text, and I often do that on a iOS device. I know I can do it on the MacBook as well, but I think, I don't know why, but I prefer to
prefer it that way.
Yeah, to use my iPad or iPhone for speech to text.
Yeah, I think the multi-device lifestyle is very good for Twitter chats. There's so much going on, and it's so easy to miss conversations or to be lost in the replies and lose where you place. And you know, there's so much to catch up with, and especially, I guess, being a host, you want to make sure you can reply to everyone and share those great ideas that are coming in. And there were so many great ideas in that chat. It was interesting to read.
Yeah, and I think even with two screens, with those hundreds of great replies. I saw some replies a couple of days later and say, how could I have missed that? And that's really great. And then commenting on it again and so on.
Yeah.
It's a really busy, intense week, but I can really recommend it to everyone to if they have a great idea for a topic, to try it out, to host a...
Yeah, I noticed you were retweeting things during the week afterwards as well, and that was nice to kind of keep the conversation going.
Yeah, was also just because there were some gold nuggets that I just had overlooked also doing the Twitter chat, because that 1 hour is so intense as a host, but also really fun, and yeah, it was nice to see that level of activity from the community. So just making a small break to say that this is meant as a bonus episode. You have already noticed that we have turned the tables, and Jacob Wolcock was so nice to ask me for our interview so that I could tell a bit about how it is to host a Apple EDU chat and tell a bit about the thought process behind the questions. And if you are listening to this podcast when it is released, it's probably the 20th of November. And then this evening it will be time for the next Apple EDU chat. And that is going to be a really interesting one. The topic is community engagement. And the hosts are Paul Tollock from the previous episode of Breakfast Conversations, together with Martin Willis. And they are both really, really good friends of mine, but they are also really some educators that put a lot of thought in their work and are involved in amazing projects. And I know they are both also very, very interested in how their school can reach out to the community and work together there. So it's going to be a really interesting chat. And if you're listening to this episode after the 20th of November, I just hope that you have enjoyed that Apple EDU chat, and that you are enjoying the Apple EDU chats that are coming up in the future as well. They are always interesting to follow, and it's good to be a part of that community. It's not only for Apple Distinguished Educators, it's also for Apple teachers and teachers in general. It's really open. It's not about tech at all. It's much more about doing a difference for kids around the world. So it's just a Twitter chat for passionate educators that are coming together. So follow those Apple EDU chats. They are normally really, really interesting. And now back to my breakfast conversation with Jacob Wolcock, where Jacob was the one that had the questions for me very unusual situation, but we really enjoyed each other's company and we had a really long conversation. So in this episode, I have done a little bit more of editing than I used to, just so that it will not be a 2 hour long episode. So there will be some small cuts in it, but now back to the conversation with Jacob Woolcock.
Definitely. I think a big part of that was inspired by the questions that you were putting out there during the hour. How did you kind of come about with those questions? What kind of process did you go through to direct the chat in those directions?
Yeah, I think in general right now I spent quite a lot of time to think about future scenarios for education, how we as teachers and school leaders can have a say in which kind of direction we want like things to evolve. So I'm quite interested in how would we are we going to learn in the future. So I knew the topic had to be about the future, and Miriam and Martin that are coordinating the EMEA chat, Twitter chat, or Apple EDU chat. They were really great at helping to craft the questions. So there is a long process where we craft the questions together and give their a response. Especially as I'm not a native speaker, it was so valuable to have their help crafting the questions.
So should we talk about some of those kind of responses and what were your highlights in terms of what you got back from the community?
Yeah, I think my thought process behind it was that the first couple of questions, the first question about how education in the ideal world would look like in 10 years from now, the idea was to get people to think about this rosy utopian dream about how amazing could education be.
The perfect education system.
Yeah, especially thinking about all those emerging technologies, and if we manage to leverage that in a good way, how interesting could education then or learning become? Mm-hmm. And the second question that was then going in this other opposite direction, in this dark dystopian direction, and say how can emerging technologies being misused, and what are our fears and concerns regarding education in the future? So they were actually thought about or thought as some couple of twins, or that we are thinking about the interesting beautiful possibilities that are coming to us, and then the dark scenarios on how they could be being misused.
Yeah, I actually found the questions quite powerful in that they weren't just about technology. They were kind of much more of a holistic overview of what's the future actually going to be like, and how are we as educators going to kind of shape that. It wasn't just about what can we do on the iPad for this. It was very much broader than that, and I enjoyed that aspect.
Yeah, and I was also, because I when I crafted the questions, I think quite a lot about this rapid development we see in artificial intelligence, but also in the biotech industry, and in all kind of industries. And I sometimes and then seeing how can the technologies then shape our society. But I was quite surprised that a lot of ADEs, they were much more or their responses, they really thought about how will our mindset shift. Will we get a mind shift where we have much more focus on creating challenge-based learning or individualizing learning, using technology to individualize learning and so on. But a lot of the responses were much more about how will our mind shift, our view of on learning change over the next 10, 20 years.
It was really interesting to see that. I think going into the chat, 10 years doesn't seem like a huge amount of time. And I think, you know, maybe... you know, 2 or 3 decades ago, perhaps over 10 years there wouldn't be a huge shift, but with technology evolving so rapidly and being used in so many ways at the moment, 10 years seems like a lifetime. And it seems like in 10 years' time, anything could actually happen and so much potentially could change.
My thought is this the people that we are teaching now and the kids that are born now, will they be one of the last generations that will not be genetically modified or optimized?
Yes.
I think we are going to see some interesting possibilities with CRISPR and so on, where we can going in and edit DNA and maybe initially we'll maybe start just to have the focus on diseases that they can inherit from their parents, that we can shut off those DNA sequences that are responsible for some of those diseases. But I think that will easily accelerate, and looking at more of those dark scenarios, and I think those who have power and economic freedom, well, they then start to say, yeah, but it should be my biological kid, but could it get 10% smarter or faster?
Yeah.
Or can we start to optimize it? And then those who don't have that financial freedom, they will just get normal kids with normal abilities.
And, gosh, that's a really interesting thing to think about, isn't it? And the ethical side of all of that is just huge. It's, you know, you could write a whole thesis on that. You could write books on the ethical dilemmas of what's going to happen in 10 or 20 years' time. And it's almost like the children themselves could become the technology of the future. You know, they themselves will become the technological advancements. And that's terrifying and exciting and everything all at once, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think often when it's possible, we humans, it's very hard for us not to do it. And I think those technologies, they allow us now to genetically modify and optimize crops and plants right now.
Yeah.
And I think very soon it will be smaller animals and then humans at some point. And that would be interesting to see if a kid that is genetically modified is maybe much smarter, much faster brain processes, and how will they actually understand their normal parents and so on? So I think there's a lot of interesting scenarios on that, but that's maybe a bit sci-fi.
It's very X-Men, isn't it?
but I think if we just think about our grandparents and I was at a birthday here at my wife's grandfather recently, and thinking about what he has lived through in the nearly 100 years where he has lived, I think it's really interesting to see. But hopefully we are still going to live 50, 60 years from now, and I think those changes, they will be massive. So
they will. It's exciting and daunting at the same time to think what's gonna change. In terms of the Twitter chat then, going away from the X-Men side of things and back towards the present day, what replies and what people who kind of contributed to that were you really impressed with in terms of their actual, you know, ideas for the future, and who kind of provided some ideas which you thought, actually, that would be amazing to have, but perhaps you hadn't considered yourself?
Yeah, in general, for the first replies, I was so... I think it was really interesting that people were much more interested in how our understanding of education and of learning could change. And there was one, Mr. Bax, who said something like that there will be fewer barriers, more connectedness. He said, I think one of the most amazing things about technology is the power it has to help us collaborate, connect, and share more freely and efficiently. It's really an exciting thing about tech in the classroom is that it allows us to connect, to collaborate, and be more efficient. So I think that was really, it started with the human, but using that technology just to become even better at that, what the humans already are good at. And then there was,
I think that connectedness is so important, isn't it? Making the world seem a bit smaller and showing the children what else is out there.
And Chris Galley, that I also recorded a podcast with recently, he wrote also that it's way more personal and adaptive learning. He saw a lot of possibilities in that and thought that was really interesting how I think this mix of a great teacher with together with a great AI, how they can maybe make much more personalized learning so that the teacher really can focus on the human connection with the learner. But having the AI to help them identify where they what kind of conversations they should have, or where the potential of the kid is, where they can push a bit more and so on.
Yes, so to kind of make the very most of the time with the children, and really focus the input and the teaching and guidance along those lines. I noticed that I think Lee Blower's put a really interesting reply as well, didn't he, about children working kind of across different grades and ages, and perhaps not being defined by year groups and classes in the same way they currently would be in most schools.
Yeah, and I really like that we,
yeah, I did,
that technology maybe can allow us to put some of those traditions that we label kids after a year group or production date, and then they come into the same class and so on, that we could use technology to actually rethink the classroom and that kids could work much more across ages together and work with other kids that have the same interest and so on.
I really like that. I think when I was first getting into teaching, my head teacher at the time was talking about how education is very often seen as like a production line. I think it's called Fordism after Henry Ford, and the children kind of come in at one end and they all move through at the same rate, at the same processes, and they come out the other end hopefully as someone who's able to go out into the world. And that system seems so outdated because children don't all progress at the same time. They don't all need the exact same processes and input along the way. And I think that what Lee was saying there very much is the way of the future, where the children kind of get what they need at the time they need it. And I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, I think just in general, what he is addressing there is that this idea about putting 28 or 35 kids in the same classroom and then having an idea that they should develop in the same pace, in different subjects and so on, is hugely ineffective. Then we always get those situations where some of those are not getting the content, but they have to move on, and then they fall really far behind, and others they are feeling bored and so on. So I think that the whole way that we today approach classrooms and around 30 kids that should move in the same pace, that's I think in 10-20 years when we look back on that, we'll don't understand why we have approached that for that way so long.
I really hope that's something that will change as time goes on. What was your kind of fear and concern about technology being misused in the future? I noticed that was quite a thought-provoking question, and for people who are very, you know, keen to use technology in the classroom, it's perhaps interesting to think about the downsides of it. So I just wondered what your fears were that kind of prompted that question.
I think I'm quite concerned about facial recognition right now.
Okay.
Also because it's a technology that has shown us that it's not only applied on things in the future. We can also take pictures that are taken 20, 30 years ago, where we not knew that technology would develop, and we can recognize the humans on that. So I'm quite concerned about privacy in general. I think we should have a lot of technology in the classroom, but I'm quite concerned that some of the data getting produced along the way, in the best intentions, maybe can be misused and have a negative impact on for some individuals later in life, especially if they serve us with information about how a kid has developed, or they have maybe had some disabilities or learning disabilities. And what if our future potential employee get access to hacked or leaked information and so on. And then I think there's a lot of ethical dilemmas in collecting all that data, and I think we should be much more aware of how we collect data and when we're deleting data and so on. I think there's a huge responsibility for schools to use data wisely. I think we shouldn't go back and write on paper, definitely not, but I just think that we also with TikTok right in the moment where we I don't know if it's better to share a lot of data with Facebook in the US and then the TikTok in China, but in general I think we should as educators use technology and inspire kids to use technology, but at the same time also have discussions about where our data ends and how it could be misused, maybe if it falls in the wrong hands and so on, and why big data is so valuable. That if we have a service that we are not paying for, then we are the product of.
Absolutely. So, I think that's something that's very difficult for children to kind of wrap their heads around, especially at a younger age, to kind of think ahead and realize, hang on, this data is all about me and that's important to me and I shouldn't be necessarily sharing that with the whole world. And when they're younger, that's quite an abstract concept. How would you kind of go about making the children more cautious and more aware of the potential for that risk?
I think that's a huge educational challenge and responsibility, but actually I think that leads into the third question, and that was, what kind of future focused projects have you already created with your learners? And then ask people to share examples. And Faye Ellis had a really good reply on that, and I remember that I had seen some of her projects, because she has done a lot of projects with her students where she actually looked critical into different tech areas. So they have made projects around technology, how it's getting used in the military, art created by artificial intelligence, relationships with AI and robots and humans and so on, and had some really interesting discussions with her students. And she had just a tweet where she said it's really fascinating to hear the students' thoughts about those topics and how interested they are in those topics. So I think we should work with technology, but also, make those kind of projects where we really ask them to reflect critically about technology, how it is getting used, and both see the great opportunities and also the dangers. And for example, when we all see the amazing robots from Boston Technology, how they have made those fantastic robots that can jump around and so on. And I, of course, meant the company Boston Dynamics and not Boston Technology. It's very easy to get fascinated by those, but I think also it's important to remember that they are a military company, and I would definitely not want to see one of those spark dots with a machine gun on the back walking into my house. So I think we should.
It's a very fine line, isn't it, between the, inspiring the children to be able to embrace technology and also be that little bit cautious and, always kind of think a little bit more about things like, the robots you talk about from Boston Dynamics. On the front, they're these really cute dog-looking things which look really exciting and great fun, but actually, the minute you start thinking about what they could be used for, it's very like Black Mirror, isn't it? That TV show about tech going wrong in the future. And there's definitely a darker side to these things if you're not perhaps careful.
I think, of course, we could use one of those humanoid robots as a firefighter coming in and rescuing people, but it could also be equipped with laser armed machine guns and other things that wouldn't be that nice. and I think also, so the technology is not maybe not good or bad, but it's often how we intentionally or not intentionally actually are using and applying that technology.
The humans behind it. But with the children we're teaching today, they're going to grow up to be the children that make the decision, the adults, sorry, that make the decisions on how these things are used. So by making them aware of it now, hopefully will put us in good stead for the future when they're the ones who are working for these companies and making these innovative developments and taking these things out into the world.
Yeah, and so I hope for schools, personally, I hope that we could see a renaissance for having philosophy in school. Or maybe a more modern way to but having that ability to really reflect deeply about human value and technology. So I think having philosophy in schools again would be really helpful in that way to work with the ethical side of biotech and tech and how we are going to use it, because we should use those possibilities. I think that's the only way that we can have just a small chance to solve those climate problems that we have and so on, that we have to use technology, but we really need a new generation that can maybe do it a bit more wisely than our generation and previous generations.
I think that links into your fourth question about if you could design the future orientated program for learning, what would that include? And it sounds like for you, philosophy would be a key part of that.
Yeah, I think for me personally, it would, yeah. But also I put the questions in because, as you maybe know, I had that opportunity a couple of years ago to start a new high school program in Denmark. And yes. It was based on challenge-based learning very cross-curricular. All the projects were together with Danish corporations, some small and some larger ones like Lego and Danfoss and so on. But all the challenges they solved were for real companies. And then the teachers have, of course, been deeply involved in designing those challenges together with the companies. But it was always a person from the company giving the students their challenge. And we were also never teaching only one subject at a time. It was always at least two teachers together with the students that could give them different angles
That's interesting.
And we tried to not talk about ourselves as teachers, but much more as learning consultants that they could use. So that was a way to try to design a program that was really designed so that they should get much more motivated, because they actually are not just making a report that will be read by one teacher and graded and then land in a drawer and end the days there. But what they really had to pitch their idea or present their view of the problem to real people from NGO or a corporate company. And that we really saw that, especially some of those boys that we had out of the program that hadn't had the best school experiences from public school or when they came onto this high school program, they really got motivated in a totally different way than they had been before. So for me, challenge-based learning, working much more with also breaking down the barrier between corporations and schools, and sometimes the schools, they are this little bubble in the society, and I think we really should use the neighborhood and our surroundings much more actively and seek those, but also letting kids valuing that their ideas and that their thought process and what they actually are able to has real value. So we should really allow them not just to make a written assignment, but really put out their things let the world see the value that it can have.
I think that's such a powerful sentiment. The children, they need to be heard. They have so many ideas, and they often are so much more creative than adults are because they haven't got this sense of maybe that's not possible. And what they can actually bring to the table and the ideas and outcomes they can achieve are hugely amazing. And having them involved in the process is key, like you say. And I think that challenge-based learning of, you mentioned having, organizations setting kind of like objectives and challenges and multiple teachers working simultaneously to bring different angles, that's so powerful. And it's such a exciting way for children to learn as well. I wish I was able to kind of learn in a school that dynamic, you know? I think that's really exciting.
So that was one of the reasons that I put it in there, but I also can't, I just know that there are so many ADEs in the community that are involved in pushing their local programs and adjusting or are pushing their schools in a more innovative direction. So also I think a lot of those who replied and so on, they maybe can see that there's a huge network that they can draw on and that they can really be very beneficial to know a bit about who are involved in what kind of innovative projects right now.
Absolutely. And again, those connections between people in different schools in different countries who all have that same passion and that same interest. The conversations on Twitter, they are a really good way of making and strengthening those connections, and they lead to new and exciting things quite often.
Yeah. But we really are also very difficult to challenging to put yourself out there and start a new program. And I think there's some ADEs doing amazing stuff right now in Glasgow and some many other places in the world right now. But I think always when we are creating those very, very big ambitious projects and creating new ways to approach learning, there are also a lot of traditional people with a traditional view on education that are just waiting for something that they can point at. So I think it's so important that we use each other when we are trying to be ambitious and innovating.
Definitely, definitely. And that expertise and experience is so helpful for that.
Yeah. So that was also the reason that I put in the fifth question on what advice would you give teachers or leaders who want to create change and implement new learning programs or have new ideas? And I thought there was a lot of good replies on that. There was, for example, Mr. DigiTech.
Sabe, yes.
Yeah. I think he works in Dubai right now. Or
he works in Sharjah.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Good that you are better informed there. But he had he said sometimes you have to go rough and ask for forgiveness later, especially if you want to, especially if you know the outcomes will be great, and the person you are trying to convince just need a worked example. But I think this whole idea about sometimes taking this chance and then be willing to ask for forgiveness instead of for permission.
Yes,
in a lot of cases it can be useful, but I think also in big projects it maybe you need to convince a board and so on before, but I
there's
think
a balance sometimes, yeah. Isn't there? Well, I think it's a really a great point though, that you know, you shouldn't be afraid to want to make change and to want to kind of push things forwards, and quite often you need to have evidence to back that up, and sometimes you only get that by doing like a pilot test or a small scale version of it first to kind of see where it takes you, and then say, actually, look how great this was. Let's do it on a bigger scale now.
Yeah, and I just think his reply reminded me about this dilemma that a lot of entrepreneurs and a lot of innovative teachers can be in, that when they have a clear vision and know what they want to achieve, it can be very hard to have that patience and convince all the people before, and they just want to put things into action. With Apple Education, we also talked about this, that some people they are swimmers and some are shark spotters, and some they will stay at the beach, but that some people they, if they want to have a vision and want to go to another island, they just jump in, swim. Other people, they will stay on the beach a bit and look for the dangers. And others, they would be so afraid of the change or the dangers involved in it that they will stay back and stay on the island where they are instead of going. And I think that was just this finding this balance. When should we have the courage just to try and then be willing to say, okay, when we want to innovate, sometimes we succeed but we also know that sometimes we will fail, but we will be aware of that and then find ways to
absolutely adapt. I think while we're talking about Salme, I should probably mention that he and his wife have had a lovely baby girl today. They've had their first child. Yeah, today, as we're recording.
And then a big shout out to
this. Absolutely. And it's quite interesting to think that, you know, a newborn baby girl today, in 10, 15 years' time, what sort of world is she going to grow up into? She's the perfect example of this future world that we're trying to build and improve, and she'll be going through that journey herself. And that's so exciting.
Yeah.
And wonderful news for that family, absolutely.
Yeah, especially. Yeah. I myself, we have two kids, and that is so amazing. I think that's the most beautiful thing that can happen in life.
Let's bring it back. Should we talk about your sixth and final question?
Yeah.
Because I think you asked a really interesting question to kind of finish that chat about, you know, the kids are going to be part of this connected, global and very flexible workforce in the future. There's no denying that. And so you finished the chat by asking, what can we do as our global communities to kind of help prepare those children for that world they're coming into? And I just wonder kind of what your thoughts were on that, and what you think we can do to prepare the children for that future world.
I think my thought process behind that question was also that I find that having this international community of teachers, of Apple teachers, Apple Distinguished Educators, and just in general, the education Twitter chat and so on, Google Innovators and so on, but being a part of very, very ambitious teachers and school leaders around the world, having that community, I think is so valuable for my own thought process and but also just for as quality to the life to feel connected globally.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I thought, how could we help kids in an early age get a similar positive experience of being globally connected? I think there's so many great educators out there that are globally connected, but how can we get that connection directly into the classroom so that the kids that they are teaching also experience something similar? So I hope that that question will lead to a lot of discussions about among teachers. Okay, how can we actually connect our classrooms, or how could we, what kind of programs or activities could lead to us a community for school kids? Could be, I think kids, they sometimes find those communities themselves on YouTube and have their interest and so on, but also could we as learning specialists help them also have a learning community together, so that it's what would not only be communities on that they find themselves, and some of them are maybe good communities and other are maybe more things where we should be a bit concerned and so on. But I think as schools we have a huge role to show them that they are part of a globalized world. Also today, having those discussions, and yesterday I heard Danish Minister for Education, she had was speaking to us yesterday at that event and so on. I think a lot of countries, they look at education on, in a national context. How can we provide some education that prepare kids for being a part of our workforce or being part of our society? And I think actually we should much more view it and see, how can we help kids being a part of a Team Planet, and not it should not be that important. I think maybe my kids, they will later on work in Denmark, but maybe they will work in Shanghai or in Mumbai.
Anywhere in the world. Yeah. Anywhere in the world.
And I think we should really raise our kids to pursue their dreams no matter where in the world they are. And I think we should try to put that national agenda bit in the background and really much more think, how can we let our kids be playing on the same team regarding country, that they say we are Team Planet, Planet Earth, and we want to create good solutions for this planet before we achieve to also live on Mars.
Absolutely, I think that connection is vital. I've actually in my classroom down in Cornwall, I've put up a new display in the last week. So I've got in my classroom four big display boards I made, and everyone can draw a board for our digital art, and everyone can code. And I was looking at the other two boards, and I thought, well, I could do everyone can photograph, everyone can use it. But I thought, actually, no, I'm going to keep the everyone can theme and make it a little bit more kind of like personal to our school. So I've put up a new board called Everyone Can Connect. And the entire board is the exact same map that I had on my iPad at the Institute over the summer. But I've taken off everyone, so it's just a plain world map. And I'm starting to put on different schools that we Skype with, or schools in France that we write pen pal letters to. And, you know, we Skyped a scientist that works at NASA from America, so we've put him on there. And I'm hoping over the course of the year that we can build up our school's own map of our connections around the world, and kind of show the children that actually we may be in Cornwall, but we can still reach out and collaborate with people around the world. So that's something I've very, very recently started. Now I'll share a picture of you afterwards.
And that's exactly the kind of initiatives that I hope to see much more. And I think it ties also so beautifully back to our first conversation. So I think my very first breakfast conversation was with you, and you talked about your ambitions to also connect the classroom more globally. So today, when I can be a guest on my own show, it's nice to hear that you have worked with that topic and are getting your classroom connected.
Definitely. I've had, on the back of that first conversation we had on the podcast, I've had quite a few people kind of get in touch and say, you know, let's do this as the year goes on. So we've kind of planned in a few things for across the course of the year. And I've, you know, got more things I'm hoping to put in place. I'm hoping by the end of our school year, that board will be quite full of different connections all around the world. And that should be quite a nice reminder for children that actually we are all kind of on this planet together, and we're all here for the common good.
Yeah, and I hope that we in relatively few years also find a way to organize our learning experiences in a way where it's totally natural for kids to hook up and make a group across borders and work together on a project, and having a team member in South Africa and having a team member in Canada and so on, and working on the same learning project. That could be really cool for kids to have those opportunities as well.
I think we should make a
huge shout out to your Smashing Apps project.
Thank you.
And definitely need to include that in the show notes so that people can find it.
So if people haven't heard, over the summer at the Institute, obviously we all had a chance to meet up, and we talked about so many things. And one evening we thought it'd be great fun to get together and share one of our favourite apps that we all use in our classrooms. And we sat down, and 10 minutes into it, we realised, hang on, we should be somewhere else. Something else is happening now. And that didn't happen after that. So when I got back, I put a message into our group chat and said, what if we try to do it over Skype? And eventually that's kind of come to pass. So we're doing it in groups of four people at a time. And the idea is we have 5 minutes to pitch our favorite classroom app. And then the other three get to kind of ask a few questions and learn a bit more about it. And we figured, let's just put it on YouTube and see what happens. And it's had a really positive response, actually. And it's hit a chord with people who kind of like to learn a little bit about what we're doing, you know?
And I think I really understand why it has get this positive response, because I think for one part, it's really interesting discussions and really interesting apps, very useful. But I also see as my own design background, it's beautiful made, and all the visuals around it and the style. So I think there would be a lot of good things to say about the content itself and the discussions that you have. But I also really like it when it has beautiful packaging and it's delivered beautifully. And I'm totally amazed by your work there.
Oh, thank you. It's very, very kind.
And the same with your videos that you're putting out on your own YouTube channel. I think it's so amazing how consistent you are and how much content you put out there. But again, once again, also really, really beautiful made.
Thank you. I think it's important to have that kind of take pride in what you're doing and have that consistency sometimes. So I that's something I very much enjoy, coming from a kind of vaguely graphic design background. That's something I've got really into. Yeah. So I'm trying to do like a quick tips video that's perhaps about a minute long every Monday morning. And then the Smashing Act is going to be the first of each month. So hopefully there'll be one coming in about a week and a half's time. And then every first of the month onwards, there'll be an episode of that released, hopefully. Yeah. That's the plan. Absolutely. Well, Jacob, it's been a pleasure taking over your podcast today.
and interviewing
you on your own podcast. So thank you for giving me that opportunity.
Yeah, I like that idea about so that was fun to try to be on the other side and have the possibility to tell a bit about the thoughts behind the questions and how it is to host a Twitter chat. I think
it's really interesting to kind of see behind the curtain of the whole Twitter chat process and how that works, but also much more interestingly to hear your own thoughts on those questions, because I think when you're asking the questions you don't get the chance to answer them. So having your answers personally tonight has been really inspiring and very motivating. So thank you for that as well. And I hope people listening to you on the podcast will get a sense of that coming through as well, Jacob.
Okay, this bonus episode became way longer than intended, but it was just so nice to catch up with Jacob Woolcock again. And I would like to thank him for giving me the opportunity to talk about the Apple EDU chat and how it is to host a chat like that and my thought process behind the questions. And very soon we will be back to a more normal schedule with the breakfast conversations. Right now I have three interviews lined up with educators from three different continents. And I'm really looking forward to share those interviews together with you, because they are really some special educators that are up in the pipeline. And dear listener, I know that you are doing some amazing work in your classroom, and please continue doing the amazing work that you are doing. Please keep inspiring the kids that you are teaching. And if you have some thoughts about this episode or about the future of education, please share them, maybe on Twitter, on other social media. Reach out to me. I would love to hear your thoughts about that. And until next time, continue your great work.